Production and village living had arrived from the Fertile Crescent after a long lag, 5,000 years, the subsequent lag for England's adoption of chiefdoms, states, riding, and especially metal tools was much shorter, 2,000 years for the first widespread metal tools of copper and bronze, and only 250 years for widespread iron tools. Evidently, it was much easier for one society of already sedentary farmers to borrow metallurgy from another such society than for nomadic hunter-gatherers to borrow food production from sedentary farmers or to be replaced by the farmers. Why were the trajectories of all key developments shifted to later dates in the Americas than in Eurasia? Four groups of reasons suggest themselves. The later start, more limited suite of wild animals and plants available for domestication, greater barriers to diffusion, and possibly smaller or more isolated areas of dense human population in the Americas than in Eurasia. As for Eurasia's head start, humans have occupied Eurasia for about a million years, far longer than they have lived in the Americas. According to the archaeological evidence discussed in Chapter 1, humans entered the Americas at Alaska only around 12,000 BC, spread south of the Canadian ice sheets as Clovis hunters a few centuries before 11,000 BC, and reached the southern tip of South America by 10,000 BC. Even if the disputed claims of older human occupation sites in the Americas prove valid, those postulated pre-Clovis inhabitants remained for unknown reasons very sparsely distributed and did not launch a Pleistocene proliferation of hunter-gatherer societies with expanding populations, technology, and art as in the Old World. Food production was already arising in the Fertile Crescent only 1,500 years after the time when Clovis-derived hunter-gatherers were just reaching southern South America. Several possible consequences of that Eurasian head start deserve consideration. First, could it have taken a long time after 11,000 BC for the Americas to fill up with people? When one works out the likely numbers involved, one finds that this effect would make only a trivial contribution to the Americas' 5,000-year lag in food-producing villages. The calculations given in Chapter 1 tell us that even if a mere 100 pioneering Native Americans had crossed the Canadian border into the lower United States and increased at a rate of only 1% per year, they would have saturated the Americas with hunter-gatherers within 1,000 years. Spreading south at a mere 1 mile per month, those pioneers would have reached the southern tip of South America only 700 years after crossing the Canadian border. Those postulated rates of spread and of population increase are very low compared with actual known rates for peoples occupying previously uninhabited or sparsely inhabited lands. Hence, the Americas were probably fully occupied by hunter-gatherers within a few centuries of the arrival of the first colonists. Second, could a large part of the 5,000-year lag have represented the time that the first Americans required to become familiar with the new local plant species, animal species, and rock sources that they encountered? If we can again reason by analogy with New Guinean and Polynesian hunter-gatherers and farmers occupying previously unfamiliar environments, such as Maori colonists of New Zealand or Tutahwe colonists of New Guinea's Karamui Basin, the colonists probably discovered the best rock sources and learned to distinguish useful from poisonous wild plants and animals in much less than a century. Third, what about Eurasians' head start in developing locally appropriate technology? The early farmers of the Fertile Crescent and China were heirs to the technology that behaviorally modern Homo sapiens had been developing to exploit local resources in those areas for tens of thousands of years. For instance, the stone sickles, underground storage pits, and other technology that hunter-gatherers of the Fertile Crescent had been evolving to utilize wild cereals were available to the first cereal farmers of the Fertile Crescent. In contrast, the first settlers of the Americas arrived in Alaska with equipment appropriate to the Siberian Arctic tundra. They had to invent for themselves the equipment suitable to each new habitat they encountered. That technology lag may have contributed significantly to the delay in Native American developments. An even more obvious factor behind the delay was the wild animals and plants available for domestication. As I discussed in Chapter 6, when hunter-gatherers adopt food production, It is not because they foresee the potential benefits awaiting their remote descendants, but because incipient food production begins to offer advantages over the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Early food production was less competitive with hunting-gathering in the Americas than in the Fertile Crescent or China, partly owing to the Americas' virtual lack of domesticable wild mammals. Hence, early American farmers remained dependent on wild animals for animal protein and necessarily remained part-time hunter-gatherers, whereas in both the Fertile Crescent and China, animal domestication followed plant domestication very closely in time to create a food-producing package that quickly won out over hunting-gathering. In addition, Eurasian domestic animals made Eurasian agriculture itself more competitive by providing fertilizer and eventually by drawing plows. Features of American wild plants also contributed to the lesser competitiveness of Native American food production. That conclusion is clearest for the eastern United States, where less than a dozen crops were domesticated, including small-seeded grains, but no large-seeded grains, pulses, fiber crops, or cultivated fruit or nut trees. It is also clear for Mesoamerica's staple grain of corn, which spread to become a dominant crop elsewhere in the Americas as well. Whereas the Fertile Crescent's wild wheat and barley evolved into crops with minimal changes, and within a few centuries, wild teosinte may have required several thousand years to evolve into corn, having to undergo drastic changes in its reproductive biology and energy allocation to seed production, loss of the seed's rock-hard casings, and an enormous increase in cob size. As a result, even if one accepts the recently postulated later dates for the onset of Native American plant domestication, about 1,500 or 2,000 years would have elapsed between that onset, about 3,000 to 2,500 B.C., and widespread year-round villages, 1,800 to 500 B.C., in Mesoamerica, the inland Andes, and the eastern United States. Native American farming served for a long time just as a small supplement to food acquisition by hunting-gathering, and supported only a sparse population. If one accepts the traditional earlier dates for the onset of American plant domestication, then 5,000 years instead of 1,500 or 2,000 years elapsed before food production supported villages. In contrast, villages were closely associated in time with the rise of food production in much of Eurasia. The hunter-gatherer lifestyle itself was sufficiently productive to support villages even before the adoption of agriculture in parts of both hemispheres, such as Japan and the Fertile Crescent in the Old World, and coastal Ecuador and Amazonia in the New World. The limitations imposed by locally available domesticates in the New World are well illustrated by the transformations of Native American societies themselves when other crops or animals arrived, whether from elsewhere in the Americas or from Eurasia. Examples include the effects of corn's arrival in the eastern United States and Amazonia, the llama's adoption in the northern Andes after its domestication to the south, and the horse's appearance in many parts of North and South America. In addition to Eurasia's head start in wild animal and plant species, developments in Eurasia were also accelerated by the easier diffusion of animals, plants, ideas, technology, and people in Eurasia than in the Americas, as a result of several sets of geographic and ecological factors. Eurasia's east-west major axis, unlike the Americas' north-south major axis, permitted diffusion without change in latitude and associated environmental variables. In contrast to Eurasia's consistent east-west breadth, the New World was constricted over the whole length of Central America, and especially at Panama. Not least, the Americas were more fragmented by areas unsuitable for food production, or for dense human populations. These ecological barriers included the rainforests of the Panamanian Isthmus, separating Mesoamerican societies from Andean and Amazonian societies, the deserts of northern Mexico separating Mesoamerica from the southwestern and southeastern societies of the United States, dry areas of Texas separating the U.S. southwest from the southeast, and the deserts and high mountains fencing off U.S. Pacific coast areas that would otherwise have been suitable for food production. As a result, there was no diffusion of domestic animals, writing, or political entities, and limited or slow diffusion of crops and technology between the New World centers of Mesoamerica, the eastern United States, and the Andes and Amazonia. Some specific consequences of these barriers within the Americas deserve mention. Food production never diffused from the U.S. Southwest and Mississippi Valley to the modern American breadbaskets of California and Oregon, where Native American societies remained hunter-gatherers merely because they lacked appropriate domesticates. The llama, guinea pig, and potato of the Andean highlands never reached the Mexican highlands. So Mesoamerica and North America remained without domestic mammals except for dogs. Conversely, the domestic sunflower of the eastern United States never reached Mesoamerica, and the domestic turkey of Mesoamerica never made it to South America or the eastern United States. Mesoamerican corn and beans took 3,000 and 4,000 years, respectively, to cover the 700 miles from Mexico's farmlands to the eastern U.S. farmlands. After corn's arrival in the eastern United States, 7 centuries more passed before the development of a corn variety productive in North American climates triggered the Mississippian emergence. Corn, beans, and squash may have taken several thousand years to spread from Mesoamerica to the U.S. Southwest, while fertile crescent crops spread west and east sufficiently fast to preempt independent domestication of the same species, or else domestication of closely related species elsewhere. The barriers within the Americas gave rise to many such parallel domestications of crops. As striking as these effects of barriers on crop and livestock diffusion are the effects on other features of human societies. Alphabets of ultimately Eastern Mediterranean origin spread throughout all complex societies of Eurasia, from England to Indonesia, except for areas of East Asia where derivatives of the Chinese writing system took hold. In contrast, the New World's sole writing systems, those of Mesoamerica, never spread to the complex Andean and Eastern U.S. societies that might have adopted them. The wheels invented in Mesoamerica as parts of toys never met the llamas domesticated in the Andes to generate wheeled transport for the New World. From east to west in the Old World, the Macedonian Empire and the Roman Empire both spanned 3,000 miles, the Mongol Empire 6,000 miles. But the empires and states of Mesoamerica had no political relations with, and apparently never even heard of, the chiefdoms of the eastern United States, 700 miles to the north, or the empires and states of the Andes, 1,200 miles to the south. The greater geographic fragmentation of the Americas compared with Eurasia is also reflected in distributions of languages. Linguists agree in grouping all but a few Eurasian languages into about a dozen language families, each consisting of up to several hundred related languages. For example, the Indo-European language family, which includes English as well as French, Russian, Greek, and Hindi, comprises about 144 languages. Quite a few of those families occupy large contiguous areas. In the case of Indo-European, the area encompassing most of Europe east through much of Western Asia to India. Linguistic, historical, and archaeological evidence combines to make clear that each of these large contiguous distributions stems from a historical expansion of an ancestral language, followed by subsequent local linguistic differentiation to form a family of related languages. Most such expansions appear to be attributable to the advantages that speakers of the ancestral language belonging to food-producing societies held over hunter-gatherers. We already discussed such historical expansions in chapters 16 and 17 for the Sino-Tibetan, Austronesian, and other East Asian language families. Among major expansions of the last millennium are those that carried Indo-European languages from Europe to the Americas and Australia, the Russian language from Eastern Europe across Siberia, and Turkish, a language of the Altaic family, from Central Asia westward to Turkey. With the exception of the Eskimo-Aleut language family of the American Arctic and the Na-Dene language family of Alaska, northwestern Canada, and the U.S. Southwest, the Americas lack examples of large-scale language expansions widely accepted by linguists. Most linguists specializing in Native American languages do not discern large clear-cut groupings other than Eskimo-Aleut and Na-Dene. At most, they consider the evidence sufficient only to group other Native American languages, variously estimated to number from 600 to 2,000, into 100 or more language groups or isolated languages. A controversial minority view is that of the linguist Joseph Greenberg, who groups all Native American languages other than Eskimo Aleut and Naudene languages into a single large family, termed Amerind, with about a dozen subfamilies. Some of Greenberg's subfamilies, and some groupings recognized by more traditional linguists, may turn out to be legacies of New World population expansions, driven in part by food production. These legacies may include the Uto-Aztecan languages of Mesoamerica and the western United States, the Oto-Mangayan languages of Mesoamerica, the Natchez-Muskogean languages of the U.S. Southeast, and the Arawak languages of the West Indies. But the difficulties that linguists have in agreeing on groupings of Native American languages reflect the difficulties that complex Native American societies themselves faced in expanding within the New World. Had any food-producing Native American peoples succeeded in spreading far with their crops and livestock and rapidly replacing hunter-gatherers over a large area, they would have left legacies of easily recognized language families, as in Eurasia, and the relationships of Native American languages would not be so controversial. Thus, we have identified three sets of ultimate factors that tipped the advantage to European invaders of the Americas. Eurasia's long head start on human settlement, its more effective food production, resulting from greater availability of domesticable wild plants, and especially of animals, and its less formidable geographic and ecological barriers to intracontinental diffusion. A fourth, more speculative ultimate factor is suggested by some puzzling non-inventions in the Americas. The non-inventions of writing and wheels in complex Andean societies. Despite a time depth of those societies approximately equal to that of complex Mesoamerican societies that did make those inventions. And wheels' confinement to toys, and their eventual disappearance in Mesoamerica, where they could presumably have been useful in human-powered wheelbarrows, as in China. These puzzles remind one of equally puzzling non-inventions, or else disappearances of inventions, in small isolated societies, including Aboriginal Tasmania, Aboriginal Australia, Japan, Polynesian Islands, and the American Arctic. Of course, the Americas in aggregate are anything but small. Their combined area is fully 76% that of Eurasia, and their human population as of AD 1492 was probably also a large fraction of Eurasia's. But the Americas, as we have seen, are broken up into islands of societies with tenuous connections to each other. Perhaps the histories of Native American wheels and writing exemplify the principles illustrated in a more extreme form by true island societies. After at least 13,000 years of separate developments, advanced American and Eurasian societies finally collided within the last 1,000 years. Until then, the sole contacts between human societies of the Old and the New Worlds had involved the hunter-gatherers on opposite sides of the Bering Strait. There were no Native American attempts to colonize Eurasia, except at the Bering Strait, where a small population of Inuit Eskimos, derived from Alaska, established itself across the strait on the opposite Siberian coast. The first documented Eurasian attempt to colonize the Americas was by the Norse at Arctic and subarctic latitudes. Norse from Norway colonized Iceland in AD 874, then Norse from Iceland colonized Greenland in AD 986, and finally, Norse from Greenland repeatedly visited the northeastern coast of North America between about AD 1000 and 1350. The sole Norse archaeological site discovered in the Americas is on Newfoundland, possibly the region described as Vinland in Norse sagas, but these also mention landings evidently farther north, on the coasts of Labrador and Baffin Island. Iceland's climate permitted herding and extremely limited agriculture, and its area was sufficient to support a Norse-derived population that has persisted to this day. But most of Greenland is covered by an ice cap, and even the two most favorable coastal fjords were marginal for Norse food production. The Greenland Norse population never exceeded a few thousand. It remained dependent on imports of food and iron from Norway, and of timber from the Labrador coast. Unlike Easter Island and other remote Polynesian islands, Greenland could not support a self-sufficient food-producing society, though it did support self-sufficient Inuit hunter-gatherer populations before, during, and after the Norse occupation period. The populations of Iceland and Norway themselves were too small and too poor for them to continue their support of the Greenland Norse population. In the Little Ice Age that began in the 13th century, the cooling of the North Atlantic made food production in Greenland and Norse voyaging to Greenland from Norway or Iceland even more marginal than before. The Greenlanders' last known contact with Europeans came in 1410 with an Icelandic ship that arrived after being blown off course. When Europeans finally began again to visit Greenland in 1577, its Norse colony no longer existed, having evidently disappeared without any record during the 15th century. But the coast of North America lay effectively beyond the reach of ships sailing directly from Norway itself, given Norse ship technology of the period AD 986 to 1410. The Norse visits were instead launched from the Greenland colony, separated from North America only by the 200-mile width of Davis Strait. However, the prospect of that tiny marginal colony sustaining an exploration, conquest, and settlement of the Americas was nil. Even the sole Norse site located on Newfoundland apparently represents no more than a winter camp occupied by a few dozen people for a few years. The Norse sagas describe attacks on their Vinland camp by people termed Skraelings, evidently either Newfoundland Indians or Dorset Eskimos. The fate of the Greenland colony, medieval Europe's most remote outpost, remains one of archaeology's romantic mysteries. Did the last Greenland Norse starve to death, attempt to sail off, intermarry with Eskimos, or succumb to disease or Eskimo arrows? While those questions of proximate cause remain unanswered, the ultimate reasons why Norse colonization of Greenland and America failed are abundantly clear. It failed because the source, Norway, the targets, Greenland and Newfoundland, and the time, AD 984 to 1410, guaranteed that Europe's potential advantages of food production, technology, and political organization could not be applied effectively. At latitudes too high for much food production, the iron tools of a few Norse, weakly supported by one of Europe's poorer states, were no match for the stone, bone, and wooden tools of Eskimo and Indian hunter-gatherers, the world's greatest masters of Arctic survival skills. The second Eurasian attempt to colonize the Americas succeeded because it involved a source, target, latitude, and time that allowed Europe's potential advantages to be exerted effectively. Spain, unlike Norway, was rich and populous enough to support exploration and subsidize colonies. Spanish landfalls in the Americas were at subtropical latitudes, highly suitable for food production, based at first mostly on Native American crops, but also on Eurasian domestic animals, especially cattle and horses. Spain's transatlantic colonial enterprise began in 1492, at the end of a century of rapid development of European ocean-going ship technology, which by then incorporated advances in navigation, sails, and ship design developed by Old World societies, Islam, India, China, and Indonesia, in the Indian Ocean. As a result, ships built and manned in Spain itself were able to sail to the West Indies. There was nothing equivalent to the Greenland bottleneck that had throttled Norse colonization. Spain's New World colonies were soon joined by those of half a dozen other European states. The first European settlements in the Americas, beginning with the one founded by Columbus in 1492, were in the West Indies. The island Indians, whose estimated population at the time of their discovery exceeded 1 million, were rapidly exterminated on most islands by disease, dispossession, enslavement, warfare, and casual murder. Around 1508, the first colony was founded on the American mainland, at the Isthmus of Panama. Conquest of the two large mainland empires, those of the Aztecs and Incas, followed in 1519 to 1520 and 1532 to 1533, respectively. In both conquests, European-transmitted epidemics, probably smallpox, made major contributions by killing the emperors themselves, as well as a large fraction of the population. The overwhelming military superiority of even tiny numbers of mounted Spaniards, together with their political skills at exploiting divisions within the native population, did the rest. European conquest of the remaining native states of Central America and northern South America followed during the 16th and 17th centuries. As for the most advanced native societies of North America, those of the U.S. Southeast and the Mississippi River system, their destruction was accomplished largely by germs alone, introduced by early European explorers and advancing ahead of them. As Europeans spread throughout the Americas, many other native societies, such as the Mandans of the Great Plains and the Saddler-Mute Eskimos of the Arctic, were also wiped out by disease without need for military action. Populous native societies, not thereby eliminated, were destroyed in the same way the Aztecs and Incas had been, by full-scale wars, increasingly waged by professional European soldiers and their native allies. Those soldiers were backed by the political organizations initially of the European mother countries, then of the European colonial governments in the New World, and finally, of the independent neo-European states that succeeded the colonial governments. Smaller native societies were destroyed more casually by small-scale raids and murders carried out by private citizens. For instance, California's native hunter-gatherers initially numbered about 200,000 in aggregate, but they were splintered among 100 triblets, none of which required a war to be defeated. Most of these triblets were killed off or dispossessed during or soon after the California Gold Rush of 1848 to 1852, when large numbers of immigrants flooded the state. As one example, the Yahi triblet of Northern California, numbering about 2,000 and lacking firearms, was destroyed in 4 raids by armed white settlers. A dawn raid on a Yahi village carried out by 17 settlers on August the 6th, 1865, a massacre of Yahis surprised in a ravine in 1866, a massacre of 33 Yahis tracked to a cave around 1867, and a final massacre of about 30 Yahis trapped in another cave by 4 cowboys around 1868. Many Amazonian Indian groups were similarly eliminated by private settlers during the rubber boom of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The final stages of the conquest are being played out in the present decade, as the Yanomano and other Amazonian Indian societies that remain independent are succumbing to disease, being murdered by miners, or being brought under control by missionaries or government agencies. The end result has been the elimination of populous Native American societies from most temperate areas suitable for European food production and physiology. In North America, those that survived as sizable intact communities now live mostly on reservations or other lands considered undesirable for European food production and mining, such as the Arctic and arid areas of the U.S. West. Native Americans in many tropical areas have been replaced by immigrants from the Old World tropics, especially black Africans, along with Asian Indians and Javanese in Suriname. In parts of Central America and the Andes, the Native Americans were originally so numerous that even after epidemics and wars, much of the population today remains Native American or mixed. That is especially true at high altitudes in the Andes, where genetically European women have physiological difficulties even in reproducing, and where native Andean crops still offer the most suitable basis for food production. However, even where Native Americans do survive, there has been extensive replacement of their culture and languages with those of the Old World. Of the hundreds of Native American languages originally spoken in North America, all except 187 are no longer spoken at all, and 149 of these last 187 are moribund in the sense that they are being spoken only by old people and no longer learned by children. Of the approximately 40 New World nations, all now have an Indo-European language or Creole as the official language. Even in the countries with the largest surviving Native American populations, such as Peru, Bolivia, Mexico, and Guatemala, a glance at photographs of political and business leaders show that they are disproportionately Europeans, while several Caribbean nations have black African leaders, and Guyana has had Asian Indian leaders. The original Native American population has been reduced by a debated large percentage. Estimates for North America range up to 95%. But the total human population of the Americas is now approximately 10 times what it was in 1492, because of arrivals of Old World peoples, Europeans, Africans, and Asians. The Americas population now consists of a mixture of peoples originating from all continents except Australia. That demographic shift of the last 500 years, the most massive shift on any continent except Australia, has its ultimate roots in developments between about 11,000 BC and 1 AD. Chapter 19, How Africa Became Black, the last chapter. No matter how much one has read about Africa beforehand, one's first impressions from actually being there are overwhelming. On the streets of Windhoek, capital of newly independent Namibia, I saw black Herero people, black Ovambos, whites, and Namas, different again from both blacks and whites. They were no longer mere pictures in a textbook, but living humans in front of me. Outside Windhoek, the last of the formerly widespread Kalahari Bushmen were struggling for survival. But what most surprised me in Namibia was a street sign. One of downtown Windhoek's main roads was called Goering Street. Surely, I thought, no country could be so dominated by unrepentant Nazis as to name a street after the notorious Nazi Reichskommissar and founder of the Luftwaffe, Hermann Goering. No, it turned out that the street instead commemorated Hermann's father, Heinrich Goering, founding Reichskommissar of the former German colony of Southwest Africa, which became Namibia. But Heinrich was also a problematic figure, for his legacy included one of the most vicious attacks by European colonists on Africans, Germany's 1904 war of extermination against the Hereros. Today, while events in neighboring South Africa command more of the world's attention, Namibia as well is struggling to deal with its colonial past and establish a multiracial society. Namibia illustrated for me how inseparable Africa's past is from its present. Most Americans and many Europeans equate Native Africans with blacks, white Africans with recent intruders, and African racial history with the story of European colonialism and slave trading. There is an obvious reason why we focus on those particular facts. Blacks are the sole Native Africans familiar to most Americans, because they were brought in large numbers as slaves to the United States. But very different peoples may have occupied much of modern black Africa until as recently as a few thousand years ago. And so-called African blacks themselves are heterogeneous. Even before the arrival of white colonialists, Africa already harbored not just blacks, but, as we shall see, five of the world's six major divisions of humanity, and three of them are confined as natives to Africa. One quarter of the world's languages are spoken only in Africa. No other continent approaches this human diversity. Africa's diverse peoples resulted from its diverse geography and its long prehistory. Africa is the only continent to extend from the northern to the southern temperate zone, while also encompassing some of the world's driest deserts, largest tropical rainforests, and highest equatorial mountains. Humans have lived in Africa far longer than anywhere else. Our remote ancestors originated there around 7 million years ago, and anatomically modern Homo sapiens may have arisen there since then. The long interactions between Africa's many peoples generated its fascinating prehistory, including two of the most dramatic population movements of the past 5,000 years. The Bantu expansion and the Indonesian colonization of Madagascar. All of those past interactions continue to have heavy consequences because the details of who arrived where before whom are shaping Africa today. How did those five divisions of humanity get to be where they are now in Africa? Why were blacks the ones who came to be so widespread, rather than the four other groups whose existence Americans tend to forget? How can we ever hope to wrest the answers to those questions from Africa's pre-literate past, lacking the written evidence that teaches us about the spread of the Roman Empire? African prehistory is a puzzle on a grand scale, still only partly solved. As it turns out, the story has some little appreciated but striking parallels with the American prehistory that we encountered in the preceding chapter. The five major human groups to which Africa was already home by AD 1000 are those loosely referred to by laypeople as blacks, whites, African pygmies, Khoisan, and Asians. Blacks were formerly confined to Africa. Pygmies and Khoisan still live only there, while many more whites and Asians live outside Africa than in it. These five groups constitute or represent all the major divisions of humanity, except for Aboriginal Australians and their relatives. Many readers may already be protesting. Don't stereotype people by classifying them into arbitrary races. Yes, I acknowledge that each of these so-called major groups is very diverse. To lump people as different as Zulus, Somalis, and Igbos under the single heading of blacks ignores the differences between them. We ignore equally big differences when we lump Africa's Egyptians and Berbers with each other, and with Europe's Swedes under the single heading of whites. In addition, the divisions between blacks, whites, and the other major groups are arbitrary because each such group shades into others. All human groups on Earth have mated with humans of every other group that they encountered. Nevertheless, as we'll see, recognizing these major groups is still so useful for understanding history that I'll use the group names as shorthand without repeating the above caveats in every sentence. Of the five African groups, representatives of many populations of blacks and whites are familiar to Americans and Europeans, and need no physical description. Blacks occupied the largest area of Africa, even as of AD 1400, the southern Sahara and most of sub-Saharan Africa. While American blacks of African descent originated mainly from Africa's west coastal zone, similar peoples traditionally occupied East Africa as well, north to the Sudan, and south to the southeast coast of South Africa itself. Whites, ranging from Egyptians and Libyans to Moroccans, occupied Africa's north coastal zone and the northern Sahara. Those North Africans would hardly be confused with blue-eyed, blonde-haired Swedes, but most laypeople would still call them whites because they have lighter skin and straighter hair than peoples to the south termed blacks. Most of Africa's blacks and whites depended on farming or herding or both for their living. In contrast, the next two groups, the Pygmies and Khoisan, include hunter-gatherers without crops or livestock. Like blacks, Pygmies have dark skins and tightly curled hair. However, Pygmies differ from blacks in their much smaller size, more reddish and less black skins, more extensive facial and body hair, and more prominent foreheads, eyes, and teeth. Pygmies are mostly hunter-gatherers, living in groups widely scattered throughout the Central African rainforest and trading with or working for neighboring black farmers. The Khoisan make up the group least familiar to Americans, who are unlikely even to have heard of their name. Formerly distributed over much of southern Africa, they consisted not only of small-sized hunter-gatherers known as San, but also of larger herders known as Khoi. These names are now preferred to the better-known terms Hottentot and Bushmen. Both the Khoi and the San look or looked quite unlike African blacks. Their skins are yellowish. Their hair is very tightly coiled, and the women tend to accumulate much fat in their buttocks, termed steatopygia. As a distinct group, the Khoi have been greatly reduced in numbers. European colonists shot, displaced, or infected many of them, and most of the survivors, interbred with Europeans to produce the populations variously known in South Africa as coloreds or bastards. The San were similarly shot, displaced, and infected, but a dwindling small number have preserved their distinctness in Namibian desert areas unsuitable for agriculture, as depicted some years ago in the widely seen film The Gods Must Be Crazy. The northern distribution of Africa's whites is unsurprising, because physically similar peoples live in adjacent areas of the Near East and Europe. Throughout recorded history, people have been moving back and forth between Europe, the Near East, and North Africa. I'll therefore say little more about Africa's whites in this chapter, since their origins aren't mysterious. Instead, the mystery involves blacks, pygmies, and Khoisan, whose distributions hint at past population upheavals. For instance, the present fragmented distribution of the 200,000 pygmies scattered amid 120 million blacks suggests that pygmy hunters were formerly widespread throughout the equatorial forests, until displaced and isolated by the arrival of black farmers. The Khoisan area of southern Africa is surprisingly small for a people so distinct in anatomy and language. Could the Khoisan, too, have been originally more widespread until their more northerly populations were somehow eliminated? I've saved the biggest anomaly for last. The large island of Madagascar lies only 250 miles off the East African coast, much closer to Africa than to any other continent, and separated by the whole expanse of the Indian Ocean from Asia and Australia. Madagascar's people proved to be a mixture of two elements. Not surprisingly, one element is African blacks, but the other consists of people instantly recognizable from their appearance as tropical Southeast Asians. Specifically, the language spoken by all the people of Madagascar, Asians, blacks, and mixed, is Austronesian, and very similar to the Ma'anyan language spoken on the Indonesian island of Borneo, over 4,000 miles across the open Indian Ocean from Madagascar. No other people remotely resembling Borneans live within thousands of miles of Madagascar. These Austronesians, with their Austronesian language and modified Austronesian culture, were already established on Madagascar by the time it was first visited by Europeans in 1500. This strikes me as the single most astonishing fact of human geography for the entire world. It's as if Columbus, on reaching Cuba, had found it occupied by blue-eyed, blond-haired Scandinavians, speaking a language close to Swedish, even though the nearby North American continent was inhabited by Native Americans speaking Amerindian languages. How on earth could prehistoric people of Borneo, presumably voyaging in boats without maps or compasses, end up in Madagascar? The case of Madagascar tells us that people's languages, as well as their physical appearance, can yield important clues to their origins. Just by looking at the people of Madagascar, we'd have known that some of them came from tropical Southeast Asia. But we wouldn't have known from which area of tropical Southeast Asia, and we'd never have guessed Borneo. What else can we learn from African languages that we didn't already know from African faces? The mind-boggling complexities of Africa's 1,500 languages were clarified by Stanford University's great linguist Joseph Greenberg, who recognized that all those languages fall into just five families. First of all, there is the Afro-Asiatic family, which basically covers Northern Africa, the Sahara, Egypt, and Iran and Iraq. Mixed in with that are several Nilo-Saharan areas where that language is spoken. Then there is the Niger-Congo region, which does not speak Bantu. That language is spoken in the area of West Africa and crosses to Central Africa. The entire southern part of Africa is the Niger-Congo Bantu region, which is basically the Bantu language family, and isolated areas of Khoisan language. And, of course, Madagascar, which is strictly the Austronesian language family. Readers accustomed to thinking of linguistics as dull and technical may be surprised to learn what fascinating contributions this distribution makes to our understanding of African history. There is a rough correspondence between language families and anatomically defined human groups. Languages of a given language family tend to be spoken by distinct people. In particular, Afro-Asiatic speakers mostly prove to be people who would be classified as whites or blacks. Nilo-Saharan and Niger-Congo speakers prove to be blacks, Khoisan speakers Khoisan, and Austronesian speakers Indonesian. This suggests that languages have tended to evolve along with the people who speak them. Concealed at the top of this diagram is our first big surprise, a big shock for Eurocentric believers in the superiority of so-called Western civilization. We're taught that Western civilization originated in the Near East, was brought to brilliant heights in Europe by the Greeks and Romans, and produced three of the world's great religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Those religions arose among peoples speaking three closely related languages, termed Semitic languages, Aramaic, the language of Christ and the apostles, Hebrew, and Arabic, respectively. We instinctively associate Semitic peoples with the Near East. However, Greenberg determined that Semitic languages really form only one of six or more branches of a much larger language family, Afro-Asiatic, all of whose other branches and other 222 surviving languages are confined to Africa. Even the Semitic subfamily itself is mainly African, 12 of its 19 surviving languages being confined to Ethiopia. This suggests that Afroasiatic languages arose in Africa, and that only one branch of them spread to the Near East. Hence, it may have been Africa that gave birth to the languages spoken by the authors of the Old and New Testaments, and the Quran, the moral pillars of Western civilization. Among Africa's five groups of people, blacks, whites, Pygmies, Khoisan, and Indonesians, only the Pygmies lack any distinct languages. Each band of Pygmies speaks the same language as the neighboring group of black farmers. However, if one compares a given language as spoken by Pygmies with the same language as spoken by blacks, the Pygmy version seems to contain some unique words with distinctive sounds. Originally, of course, people as distinctive as the Pygmies living in a place as distinctive as the equatorial African rainforest were surely isolated enough to develop their own language family. However, today those languages are gone. The Pygmies' modern distribution is highly fragmented. Thus, distributional and linguistic clues combine to suggest that the Pygmy homeland was engulfed by invading black farmers, whose languages the remaining Pygmies adopted, leaving only traces of their original languages in some words and sounds. We saw previously that much the same is true of the Malaysian Negritos, Samang, and Philippine Negritos, who adopted Austroasiatic and Austronesian languages respectively from the farmers who came to surround them. The fragmented distribution of Nilo-Saharan languages similarly implies that many speakers of those languages have been engulfed by speakers of Afroasiatic or Niger-Congo languages. But the distribution of Khoisan languages testifies to an even more dramatic engulfing. Those languages are famously unique in the whole world in their use of clicks as consonants. If you've been puzzled by the Bushman name spelled exclamation point, K-U-N-G, pronounced Kung, the exclamation mark is not an expression of premature astonishment. It's just how linguists denote a click. All existing Khoisan languages are confined to southern Africa, with two exceptions. Those exceptions are two very distinctive click-laden Khoisan languages named Hadza and Sandawe, stranded in Tanzania more than 1,000 miles from the nearest Khoisan languages of southern Africa. In addition, Xhosa and a few other Niger-Congo languages of southern Africa are full of clicks. Even more unexpectedly, clicks or Khoisan words appear in two Afroasiatic languages spoken by blacks in Kenya, stranded still farther from present Khoisan peoples than are the Hadza and Sandawe peoples of Tanzania. All this suggests that Khoisan languages and peoples formerly extended far north of their present southern African distribution, until they too, like the Pygmies, were engulfed by the blacks, leaving only linguistic legacies of their former presence. That's a unique contribution of the linguistic evidence, something we could hardly have guessed just from physical studies of living people. I have saved the most remarkable contribution of linguistics for last. The Niger-Congo language family is distributed all over West Africa and most of sub-equatorial Africa, apparently giving no clue as to where within that enormous range the family originated. However, Greenberg recognized that all Niger-Congo languages of sub-equatorial Africa belong to a single language subgroup termed Bantu. That subgroup accounts for nearly half of the 1,032 Niger-Congo languages and for more than half, nearly 200 million, of the Niger-Congo speakers. But all those 500 Bantu languages are so similar to each other that they have been facetiously described as 500 dialects of a single language. Collectively, the Bantu languages constitute only a single low-order subfamily of the Niger-Congo language family. Most of the 176 other subfamilies are crammed into West Africa, a small fraction of the entire Niger-Congo range. In particular, the most distinctive Bantu languages and the non-Bantu Niger-Congo languages, most closely related to Bantu languages, are packed into a tiny area of Cameroon and adjacent eastern Nigeria. Evidently, the Niger-Congo language family arose in West Africa. The Bantu branch of it arose at the east end of that range, in Cameroon and Nigeria. And the Bantu then spread out of that homeland over most of sub-equatorial Africa. That spread must have begun long ago enough that the ancestral Bantu language had time to split into 500 daughter languages, but nevertheless recently enough that all those daughter languages are still very similar to each other. Since all other Niger-Congo speakers, as well as the Bantu, are blacks, we couldn't have inferred who migrated in which direction just from the evidence of physical anthropology. To make this type of linguistic reasoning clear, let me give you a familiar example, the geographic origins of the English language. Today, by far, the largest number of people whose first language is English live in North America, with others scattered over the globe in Britain, Australia, and other countries. Each of those countries has its own dialects of English. If we knew nothing else about language distributions and history, we might have guessed that the English language arose in North America and was carried overseas to Britain and Australia by colonists. But all those English dialects form only one low-order subgroup of the Germanic language family. All the other subgroups, the various Scandinavian, German, and Dutch languages, are crammed into northwestern Europe. In particular, Frisian, the other Germanic language most closely related to English, is confined to a tiny coastal area of Holland and western Germany. Hence, a linguist would immediately deduce correctly that the English language arose in coastal northwestern Europe and spread around the world from there. In fact, we know from recorded history that English really was carried from there to England by invading Anglo-Saxons in the 5th and 6th centuries A.D. Essentially, the same line of reasoning tells us that the nearly 200 million Bantu people, now flung over much of the map of Africa, arose from Cameroon and Nigeria. Along with the North African origins of Semites and the origins of Madagascar's Asians, that's another conclusion that we couldn't have reached without linguistic evidence. We had already deduced from Khoisan language distributions and the lack of distinct Pygmy languages that Pygmies and Khoisan peoples had formerly ranged more widely until they were engulfed by blacks. I'm using engulfing as a neutral, all-embracing word regardless of whether the process involved conquest, expulsion, interbreeding, killing, or epidemics. We've now seen from Niger-Congo language distributions that the blacks who did the engulfing were the Bantu. The physical and linguistic evidence considered so far has let us infer these prehistoric engulfings, but it still hasn't solved their mysteries for us. Only the further evidence that I'll now present can help us answer two more questions. What advantages enabled the Bantu to displace the Pygmies and Khoisan? When did the Bantu reach the former Pygmy and Khoisan homelands? To approach the question about the Bantu's advantages, let's examine the remaining type of evidence from the living present, the evidence derived from domesticated plants and animals. As we saw in previous chapters, that evidence is important because food production led to high population densities, germs, technology, political organizations, and other ingredients of power. Peoples who, by accident of their geographic location, inherited or developed food production thereby became able to engulf geographically less endowed people. When Europeans reached sub-Saharan Africa in the 1400s, Africans were growing five sets of crops, each of them laden with significance for African history. The first set was grown only in North Africa, extending to the highlands of Ethiopia. North Africa enjoys a Mediterranean climate, characterized by rainfall concentrated in the winter months. Southern California also experiences a Mediterranean climate, explaining why my basement and that of millions of other Southern Californians often gets flooded in the winter, but infallibly dries out in the summer. The Fertile Crescent, where agriculture arose, enjoys that same Mediterranean pattern of winter rains. Hence, North Africa's original crops all proved to be ones adapted to germinating and growing with winter rains, and known from archaeological evidence to have been first domesticated in the Fertile Crescent beginning around 10,000 years ago. Those Fertile Crescent crops spread into climatically similar adjacent areas of North Africa and laid the foundations for the rise of ancient Egyptian civilization. They include such familiar crops as wheat, barley, peas, beans, and grapes. These are familiar to us precisely because they also spread into climatically similar adjacent areas of Europe, thence to America and Australia, and became some of the staple crops of temperate zone agriculture around the world. As one travels south in Africa, across the Saharan Desert, and re-encounters rain in the Sahel zone just south of the desert, one notices that Sahel rains fall in the summer rather than in the winter. Even if Fertile Crescent crops adapted to winter rain could somehow have crossed the Sahara, they would have been difficult to grow in the summer rain Sahel zone. Instead, We find two sets of African crops whose wild ancestors occur just south of the Sahara and which are adapted to summer rains and less seasonal variation in day length. One set consists of plants whose ancestors are widely distributed from west to east across the Sahel zone and were probably domesticated there. They include, notably, sorghum and pearl millet, which became the staple cereals of much of sub-Saharan Africa. Sorghum proved so valuable that it is now grown in areas with hot, dry climates on all the continents, including in the United States. The other set of plants, whose wild ancestors occur in Ethiopia and were probably domesticated there in the highlands. Most are still grown mainly just in Ethiopia and remain unknown to Americans, including Ethiopia's narcotic chat, its banana-like ensete, its oily noug, its finger millet, used to brew its national beer, and its tiny-seeded cereal called teff, used to make its national bread. But every reader addicted to coffee can thank ancient Ethiopian farmers for domesticating the coffee plant. It remained confined to Ethiopia until it caught on in Arabia and then around the world to sustain today the economies of countries as far-flung as Brazil and Papua New Guinea. The next-to-last set of African crops arose from wild ancestors in the wet climate of West Africa. Some, including African rice, have remained virtually confined there. Others, such as African yams, spread throughout other areas of sub-Saharan Africa. And two, the oil palm and kola nut, reached other continents. West Africans were chewing the caffeine-containing nuts of the latter as a narcotic long before the Coca-Cola Company enticed first Americans and then the world to drink a beverage originally laced with its extracts. The last batch of African crops is also adapted to wet climates, but it provides the biggest surprise. Bananas, Asian yams, and taro were already widespread in sub-Saharan Africa in the 1400s, and Asian rice was established on the coast of East Africa. But those crops originated in tropical Southeast Asia. Their presence in Africa would astonish us if the presence of Indonesian people on Madagascar had not already alerted us to Africa's prehistoric Asian connection. Did Austronesians sailing from Borneo land on the East African coast, bestow their crops on grateful African farmers, pick up African fishermen, and sail off into the sunrise to colonize Madagascar, leaving no other Austronesian traces in Africa? The remaining surprise is that all of Africa's indigenous crops, those of the Sahel, Ethiopia, and West Africa, originated north of the equator. Not a single African crop originated south of it. This already gives us a hint why speakers of Niger-Congo languages stemming from north of the equator were able to displace Africa's equatorial pygmies and sub-equatorial Khoisan people. The failure of the Khoisan and pygmies to develop agriculture was due not to any inadequacy of theirs as farmers, but merely to the accident that southern Africa's wild plants were mostly unsuitable for domestication. Neither Bantu nor white farmers, heirs to thousands of years of farming experience, were subsequently able to develop southern African native plants into food crops. Africa's domesticated animal species can be summarized much more quickly than its plants, because there are so few of them. The sole animal that we know for sure was domesticated in Africa, because its wild ancestor is confined there, is a turkey-like bird called the guinea fowl. Wild ancestors of domestic cattle, donkeys, pigs, dogs, and house cats were native to North Africa, but also to Southwest Asia, so we can't yet be certain where they were first domesticated, although the earliest dates currently known for domestic donkeys and house cats favor Egypt. Recent evidence suggests that cattle may have been domesticated independently in North Africa, Southwest Asia, and India, and that all three of those stocks have contributed to modern African cattle breeds. Otherwise, all the remainder of Africa's domestic mammals must have been domesticated elsewhere and introduced as domesticates to Africa, because their wild ancestors occur only in Eurasia. Africa's sheep and goats were domesticated in Southwest Asia, its chickens in Southeast Asia, its horses in southern Russia, and its camels probably in Arabia. The most unexpected feature of this list of African domestic animals is again a negative one. The list includes not a single one of the big wild mammal species for which Africa is famous, and which it possesses in such abundance, its zebras and wildebeests, its rhinos and hippos, its giraffes and buffalo. As we'll see, that reality was as fraught with consequences for African history as was the absence of native domestic plants in sub-equatorial Africa. This quick tour through Africa's food staples suffices to show that some of them traveled a long way from their points of origin, both inside and outside Africa. In Africa, as elsewhere in the world, some peoples were much luckier than others, in the suites of domesticable wild plant and animal species that they inherited from their environment. By analogy with the engulfing of Aboriginal Australian hunter-gatherers by British colonists fed on wheat and cattle, we have to suspect that some of the lucky Africans parlayed their advantage into engulfing their African neighbors. Now at last, let's turn to the archaeological record to find out who engulfed whom when. What can archaeology tell us about actual dates and places for the rise of farming and herding in Africa? Any reader steeped in the history of Western civilization would be forgiven for assuming that African food production began in ancient Egypt's Nile Valley, land of the pharaohs and pyramids. After all, Egypt by 3000 BC was undoubtedly the site of Africa's most complex society, and one of the world's earliest centers of writing. In fact, though, possibly the earliest archaeological evidence for food production in Africa comes instead from the Sahara. Today, of course, much of the Sahara is so dry that it cannot support even grass. But between about 9000 and 4000 BC, the Sahara was more humid, held numerous lakes, and teemed with game. In that period, Saharans began to tend cattle and make pottery, then to keep sheep and goats. And they may also have been starting to domesticate sorghum and millet. Saharan pastoralism precedes the earliest known date, 5200 BC, for the arrival of food production in Egypt, in the form of a full package of Southwest Asian winter crops and livestock. Food production also arose in West Africa and Ethiopia, and by around 2500 BC, cattle herders had already crossed the modern border from Ethiopia into northern Kenya. While those conclusions rest on archaeological evidence, there is also an independent method for dating the arrival of domestic plants and animals, by comparing the words for them in modern languages. Comparisons of terms for plants in southern Nigerian languages of the Niger-Congo family show that the words fall into three groups. First are cases in which the word for a particular crop is very similar in all those southern Nigerian languages. Those crops prove to be ones like West African yams, oil palm, and kola nut, plants that were already believed on botanical and other evidence to be native to West Africa and first domesticated there. Since those are the oldest West African crops, all modern southern Nigerian languages inherited the same original set of words for them. Next come crops whose names are consistent only among the languages falling within a small subgroup of those southern Nigerian languages. Those crops turn out to be ones believed to be of Indonesian origin, such as bananas and Asian yams. Evidently, those crops reached southern Nigeria only after languages began to break up into subgroups. So each subgroup coined or received different names for the new plants, which the modern languages of only that particular subgroup inherited. Last come crop names that aren't consistent within language groups at all, but instead follow trade routes. These proved to be New World crops like corn and peanuts, which we know were introduced into Africa after the beginnings of transatlantic ship traffic AD 1492, and diffused since then along trade routes, often bearing their Portuguese or other foreign names. Thus, even if we possessed no botanical or archaeological evidence whatsoever, we would still be able to deduce from the linguistic evidence alone that native West African crops were domesticated first, that Indonesian crops arrived next, and that finally the European introductions came in. The UCLA historian Christopher Errett has applied this linguistic approach to determining the sequence in which domestic plants and animals became utilized by the people of each African language family. By a method termed glottochronology, based on calculations of how rapidly words tend to change over historical time, comparative linguistics can even yield estimated dates for domestications or crop arrivals. Putting together direct archaeological evidence of crops with the more indirect linguistic evidence, we deduce that the people who were domesticating sorghum and millet in the Sahara thousands of years ago spoke languages ancestral to modern Nilo-Saharan languages. Similarly, the people who first domesticated wet country crops of West Africa spoke languages ancestral to the modern Niger-Congo languages. Finally, speakers of ancestral Afro-Asiatic languages may have been involved in domesticating the crops native to Ethiopia, and they certainly introduced Fertile Crescent crops to North Africa. Thus, the evidence derived from plant names in modern African languages permits us to glimpse the existence of three languages being spoken in Africa thousands of years ago: ancestral Nilo-Saharan, ancestral Niger-Congo, and ancestral Afro-Asiatic. In addition, we can glimpse the existence of ancestral Khoisan from other linguistic evidence, though not that of crop names, because ancestral Khoisan people domesticated no crops. Now, surely, since Africa harbors 1,500 languages today, it is big enough to have harbored more than four ancestral languages thousands of years ago. But all those other languages must have disappeared, either because the people speaking them survived but lost their original language, like the Pygmies, or because the people themselves disappeared. The survival of modern Africa's four native language families, that is, the four other than the recently arrived Austronesian language of Madagascar, isn't due to the intrinsic superiority of those languages as vehicles for communication. Instead, it must be attributed to a historical accident. Ancestral speakers of Nilo-Saharan, Niger-Congo, and Afro-Asiatic happened to be living at the right place and time to acquire domestic plants and animals, which let them multiply and either replace other peoples or impose their language. The few modern Khoisan speakers survived mainly because of their isolation in areas of southern Africa unsuitable for Bantu farming. Before we trace Khoisan survival beyond the Bantu tide, let's see what archaeology tells us about Africa's other great prehistoric population movement, the Austronesian colonization of Madagascar. Archaeologists exploring Madagascar have now proved that Austronesians had arrived at least by 800 AD, possibly as early as 300 AD. There, the Austronesians encountered and proceeded to exterminate a strange world of living animals as distinctive as if they had come from another planet, because those animals had evolved on Madagascar during its long isolation. They included giant elephant birds, primitive primates called lemurs as big as gorillas, and pygmy hippos. Archaeological excavations of the earliest human settlements on Madagascar yield remains of iron tools, livestock, and crops, so the colonists were not just a small canoe load of fishermen blown off course, they formed a full-fledged expedition. How did that prehistoric 4,000-mile expedition come about? One hint is in an ancient book of sailors' directions, The Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, written by an anonymous merchant living in Egypt around 100 AD. The merchant describes an already thriving sea trade connecting India and Egypt with the coast of East Africa. With the spread of Islam after 800 AD, Indian Ocean trade becomes well documented archaeologically by copious quantities of Mideastern and occasionally even Chinese products, such as pottery, glass, and porcelain in East African coastal settlements. The traders waited for favorable winds to let them cross the Indian Ocean directly between East Africa and India. When the Portuguese navigator Vasco da Gama became the first European to sail around the southern Cape of Africa and reached the Kenya coast in 1498, he encountered Swahili trading settlements and picked up a pilot who guided him on that direct route to India. But there was an equally vigorous sea trade from India eastward between India and Indonesia. Perhaps the Austronesian colonists of Madagascar reached India from Indonesia by that eastern trade route and then fell in with the westward trade route to East Africa, where they joined with Africans and discovered Madagascar. That union of Austronesians and East Africans lives on today in Madagascar's basically Austronesian language, which contains loanwords from coastal Kenyan Bantu languages. But there are no corresponding Austronesian loanwords in Kenyan languages. And other traces of Austronesians are very thin on the ground in East Africa, mainly just Africa's possible legacy of Indonesian musical instruments, xylophones and zithers, and, of course, the Austronesian crops that became so important in African agriculture. Hence, one wonders whether Austronesians, instead of taking the easier route to Madagascar via India and East Africa, somehow, incredibly, sailed straight across the Indian Ocean, discovered Madagascar, and only later got plugged into East African trade routes. Thus, some mystery remains about Africa's most surprising fact of human geography. What can archaeology tell us about the other great population movement in recent African prehistory, the Bantu expansion? We saw from the twin evidence of modern peoples and their languages that sub-Saharan Africa was not always a black continent, as we think of it today. Instead, this evidence suggested that pygmies had once been widespread in the rainforest of Central Africa, while Khoisan people